What we were saying is, well, the first statement was that we can think of the geometry of five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, for that matter, any dimensional anti-de Sitter space as a cylinder where time propagates up and the cross-section of the cylinder is some sphere, okay? We also noticed that by looking at the metric of anti-de Sitter space that it has the peculiar property that in order to define evolution in the geometry, you have to specify boundary conditions at the boundary of space to decide whether a light ray, just to really specify what the data is. I mean, you could have things coming in from outside, or you could have things leaking out. And we also saw that I recall for you what the dictionary of the parameters was. I told you that lambda, remember, which is the, so for today, I'm going to be discussing the correspondence in the large N tooth limit. And I said that the tooth limit, the tooth coupling constant corresponds in the gauge theory, corresponds to measuring the radius of curvature of the phi sphere or anti de Sitter in string units. And that n, which is the rank of the gauge group or the size of the n by n matrices, corresponds to measuring the radius of the phi sphere in Planck units. Oh, sorry, this should be a 4. This should be a 4. Remember that we're always matching dimensionless things to dimensionless things. So before maybe going through this again, it's worth understanding what descriptions are weakly coupled or simple. And that means that you can use perturbation theory to calculate, depending on what range these various parameters take. So let's see this a little bit. Just to show that this type of correspondence allows you to compute very hard things in one theory in terms of simple things in the other. But that's why it's very useful, because you want to solve things that are very difficult by doing something simple. And this exactly allows you to do it, of course, for a special class of theories. So first of all, if n is very, very large, then quantum gravity corrections, remember that exactly this combination is the one that would measure the effects of quantum gravity in a geometry, okay? Is that statement mysterious or known, or? Maybe it's known, okay? So that means that if you study the theory in the large N limit, this corresponds to classical gravity. Okay. Okay, I have to be a bit more careful, but now you have this other parameter lambda. If lambda is very, very small, so the tooth coupling is very, very small, let me do it this way. If lambda is very, very, very small, then gauge theory perturbative gauge theory is a good approximation. You can use Feynman diagrams to compute things in a power series expansion in the coupling. While if lambda is very, very small, string corrections. If lambda is very, very small, then L string over L, I mean, this ratio is very small, and that means that corrections, the curvature of the ADS geometry is getting large in string units, okay? So that means that you have classical string theory Because in principle, string theory knows about all the possible corrections in this expansion in terms of the string length. That's what string theory does. So that's one regime. In the other regime, lambda much, much bigger than one, then we don't have any perturbative methods in field theory, because the usual Feynman diagram expansion really doesn't make any sense when lambda is not a small parameter. But then in this case, the curvature of spacetime in string units is very small, and I can use semi-classical gravity. In this regime, string effects are not very important, and I can use just the point particle limit of string theory, which is gravity or supergravity. Okay. So in particular, means that if I want to solve a gauge theory in the strong coupling limit, where the coupling is getting large here, I can map this problem to a problem in semi-classical gravity, which means that I would describe the physics inside the cylinder here by Einstein gravity coupled to matter fields. Exactly the matter fields that I said that the correspondence requires that it's there for every operator in the theory. The statement was that for every operator that I can write down in the boundary theory, there should be a bulk field. Yes?
The first line, you're saying that we're in the classical string theory regime.
Yes.
That involves an assumption about the value of n?
Well, yeah, I'm always in the Lagrangian limit. Okay. Yes, sorry. If we're not in the Lagrangian limit, then we don't know how to compute in any size, essentially, because that means that you need to know you're doing quantum gravity on one side, because you have to include 1/L1 corrections. And in the field theory, you would have to know how to compute non-planar corrections, which in principle we know how to do in particular setups, yes.
But for n equals 4, I mean, 4 is not that large, right?
Oh, sorry, but this n, okay. This calligraphic n, which counts the number of supersymmetries, and then there is the n, which tells you the size of the matrix. And so this n is the size of the matrix, not the calligraphic n. Sorry. This happens more often than
the lambda of the spinner, either.
The lambda. Well, a spinner equal a number, that would be pretty well. Okay. So that now you can get a sense of how you can use the duality depending on what your main interest is. If your main interest is quantum gravity, you could try to use gauge theory to answer questions about quantum gravity. Or if you're interested in strongly coupled field theories, you can try to use semi-classical gravity to find information about strongly coupled field theories. Okay, so then we were discussing the how to use the correspondence in some sense. Right now, I just made a statement about the parameters. We want to know how to translate observables in one theory into the other, and I started with the local operators. So we said that we have a whole bunch of local operators in the field theory that you can list, and we're interested in computing the correlation function of such operators in the conformal field theory. And there is a prescription, which I already outlined. This object here in between brackets is the generating functional of all connected, because, well, this object of connected correlation functions, because I can obtain any correlation. If someone gave you this object, you would compute arbitrary correlation functions by taking arbitrary number of derivatives with respect to the source. We should think of phi zero as a source for this operator, and then evaluating it at phi not equal zero. So in particular, okay, just to be explicit, I mean, if you compute the second derivative, it will give you the, and then I evaluated at phi naught equal zero. This would give you okay. And this is exactly the object that we're interested in a conformal field theory, the correlation functions of local operators. And the prescription is the following. As I said, the The Cauchy problem in ADS is not well defined unless I specify boundary conditions. So the rule that we'll have to do is going to be to solve the physics in the bulk here, subject to certain boundary conditions. And the precise correspondence is this. We are going to identify, usually in field theory, the source is just an auxiliary quantity that you put to write down your generating function. It has no real meaning. Here it has actually a very vivid meaning. The field that corresponds to this operator, we impose the boundary condition that when this field approaches the boundary of the space, which is where the field theory lives, the value of the field should go to the source, should match the value of the corresponding source. Okay? So essentially, you have to solve a Dirichlet problem like in electromagnetism. You have some equations of motion that, for example, in this approximation of semi-classical gravity just corresponds to Einstein gravity with matter fields, subject to some boundary conditions. So you have to solve some Laplace-type problem, which we know how to do in this regime. Okay? Yes? It's the same. Okay, both of them have the same size. That follows from the equations of motion.
Okay.
If there were any other size, there would be a problem already with the number of parameters. And by radius, I mean, I think it's clear what I mean by the radius of ADS 5. I mean the size of the hyperboloid, even though it's non-compact. It's a non-compact space. Another way of saying it is that 1 over L squared is the curvature of the space. OK? So this is the prescription. Let me just give you a flavor of how to use it. To do it in practice, doing these computations here in practice is a bit complicated. And I think I'll give you maybe an exercise for you to become familiar. It's fairly straightforward, but it's a bit messy to write it in Blackboard. I'll give you the simplest example of how to compute precisely this object, the two-point function in the conformal field theory using the bulk gravity correspondence. And then I'll give you another example in which the holographic correspondence between how the data at the boundary and the bulk are related is most vivid, which is for the example of Wilson loops in gauge theory. And there actually we will see how strings emerge in the bulk of ADS. So let's think a little bit about this problem. I think once we understand the problem for the two-point function, in principle, you would know how to extend it for any correlation function. So imagine we're interested in computing this in the conformal field theory. And we'll be computing the two-point function of the same operator for simplicity. And this will connect, by the way, with the yesterday's tutorial where I asked you to determine the position dependence of the two-point function of an operator of dimension delta in a conformal field theory. So dual or corresponding to this operator, we are supposed to have a bulk field. Phi x of z. Z, remember, is always the extra direction, kind of the radial direction of ADS. And now we want to solve the problem of essentially, so semi-classically, okay, so this was kind of maybe a little bit abstract, but I mean by the bulk partition function of string theory with these boundary conditions. In the semi-classical approximation, this guy, this Z bulk, that with this boundary condition, as z goes to 0, just corresponds to the following thing. What you do is you solve the equations of motion, so you have a Lagrange, yes?
So you mean that phi corresponds to the source that couples to theta, right?
Yes. So another question is that literally for every field in the bulk. This is a dynamical field. I mean, the reason I don't perhaps want to say it like that is that this is a dynamical field in the bulk, while the source is just something not dynamical. But it's true that you have a dynamical field in the bulk for every operator, and when this dynamical field approaches the boundary, it approaches some arbitrary function that you, sorry, this should be x, right? That you specify. Okay? Any question?
Z equals 0 is the boundary. Right?
Z equals 0 is the boundary, yes.
And so this is saying that we're taking the partition function of the fields in the bulk that approach phi 0 at the boundary?
Yes. It's like solving an electrostatics problem where you say the electric field at the boundary has to be whatever it has to be. And you solve the equations of motion with those boundary conditions. You plug it back into the action. And it gives you a functional of the boundary conditions. OK? So in practice, that's exactly what you do. You solve the equations of motion in the bulk with the prescribed boundary conditions. And in the semi-classical approximation, then you plug it back, the solution, you plug it back into the action. And this gives you precisely, if you have a bulk semi-classical action, you plug in the solution, essentially, phi, if you wish, is a function of phi 0. OK? And then now to pick out any particular correlator, you look at the classical action as a function of the sources, as a function of the boundary condition, and you start differentiating. And that's how you can compute these things. So let's do a simple example, the simplest example, kind of a toy model, for the two-point function here of a scalar field, or operator that's a scalar. I'm not doing it for the metric, because that would be more complicated. There will be indices all over the place, and it would obscure the physics. So let's just do it for a scalar field. So dual to this operator O of x, we have this field phi of x and z. And its bulk action. What is the simplest bulk action that a scalar field can have in ABS? Yeah, so let's consider just, for example, the free scalar fields. This will be sufficient for this problem. So you would go have d5x, because we're in a five-dimensional anti-distributed space. The square root of g is the ABS 5 metric. And then we have d5 squared plus 1/2 m squared phi squared. So now we're instructed to solve the problem, the following problem. What is the equation of motion that follows from this? It's just the Lambertian equation. You have minus, don't trust me on any sign. Phi equals 0. With, very importantly, this would be like the analog of the Laplace equation in electromagnetism, with the boundary condition that phi, our favorite boundary condition by now, at z equals 0. Here I'm glossing over some issue of that you have to take the z goes to 0 limit in a careful way. But as a first pass, let's ignore this subtlety, where this guy is going to equal our beloved source, phi 0 of x. So the way you solve this, you know it very well, is by using Green's function. So what you say is that phi evaluated as a function of x and z is the integral over a propagator, a Green's function, which is called the bulk to boundary propagator, which this k, as I said, is called the bulk to boundary propagator. I mean, it should be clear why, because it's an object that connects an arbitrary point in the bulk, because it's labeled by x and z, to an arbitrary point in the boundary x prime. Yes?
The image derivative in the Klein-Gordon action, is there a derivative with respect to z?
Also everything. Five dimensional, yes. Mm-hmm. Everything. And what is this guy? Well, this guy satisfies the following, has to satisfy the following equation. I think I have a mind like that, but anyway.
Just wondering, where does the 5 sphere come into this? Because so far we've worked almost entirely, we've just used the ADS part of the.
Okay, that's a good question. So the point is that 5 sphere is a compact space. So any field theory that lives on ADS 5 times a sphere, you can always do a Kaluza-Klein harmonic decomposition of any field that lives in 10 dimensions. You can decompose it into an infinite number of fields that live in 5 dimensions. Just like if you want to think of a theory in 4+1 dimension, where you have a circle. You can either think of that as a field theory with one field in 4+1 dimension, or as a theory in 4 dimensions with an infinite number of fields. One per its harmonic on the circle. And here it's exactly the same. So the 5 sphere, I mean, you can also do harmonic decomposition. There are spherical harmonics, the generalization of the usual spherical harmonic to the 5 sphere. So any field in 10 dimensions can be rewritten in terms of an infinite number of fields in ADS 5. And exactly this infinite number of fields, for a special case of modes, matches precisely with some of these operators I was writing down. Like I also had an infinite number of operators, like trace phi, remember I had all of those. Those are exactly in one-to-one correspondence with the harmonics that you would get from a field in 10 dimensions coming down to 5 dimensions. Because, once you reduce on the 5 sphere, the field that you will get in low dimensions will transform, will have a non-trivial spin with respect to the rotations on the sphere, which is exactly the quantum numbers that the operators I wrote down had. Yes?
The field to get on the lower dimensional,
yes. In general, they become massive.
They become massive?
Oh, no. Everything, typically in ADS, unlike flat space, everything is massive.
Massive.
So in general, you're going to have an infinite number of fields with certain masses. In generically, you don't have massless fields when you do this reduction. Unlike for the circle case, you get a massless field. If you just take a theory on a circle, and you keep kind of the constant mode on the circle. If the higher dimensional field was massless, the lightest mode in the fourth dimensional theory will be massless. All the other modes will be massive. But here, even if you start with massless modes in the higher dimensional theory, because of the cookie properties of the phi sphere, it is not a circle. It has curvature. That's the point. It has a curvature. A circle doesn't have curvature. Even the what you would call the massless mode is massive. It has a mass. So all of them has mass. Well, you can have one. I mean, there could be an accident and you get a massless scalar, but typically you don't get a massless scalar. So I'm just doing the general case. So we essentially solve this Dirichlet problem. It solves the equivalence of motion. And, okay, the thing I have to tell you is that phi, I mean, this bulk to boundary propagator, in the limit that you approach the boundary, gives you precisely modulo, again, I'm being a bit sloppy with the fact that you have to be careful about how you take the z goes to zero limit, but modulo the subtlety, that I want to skip for the first pass, you get exactly, a delta function of x minus x prime. So that means that we have solved the problem. We solved the equations of motion, and if I plug this into here, when I take the limit that z goes to zero, I get exactly the boundary condition. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, and why would we add the Delambre equation on the wave equation on K? Why don't we get delta functions?
Well, so that would be for the bulk to bulk propagator. So that would be true if I'm solving different. So the way you can picture this is that I'm starting the propagation. So now I'm looking at the cylinder from the top. So I'm propagating something from X prime to an arbitrary point here, X and Z. The propagator you're talking about would be the bulk, what's called the bulk to bulk propagator, which actually would appear if we were computing the 3-point function, which probably I will not do in the lecture. But this would correspond when you have a propagator that relates points X, X1, Z1, with points X2, Z2. Then this propagator, this Green's function, would satisfy precisely what you said. 1 over root G delta X1 minus X2 delta Z1 minus Z2. But luckily, we don't have to worry about this guy for the computation of the 2-point function. If we did the 3-point function, we would have to worry about it. I want, okay, maybe I'll tell you a little bit why. Okay, so now let's finish the task. So we computed the field. Now I just have to plug it into the classical action, which I'm not going to do for you explicitly, but it's clear what you have to do. You have this field configuration, right? You just plug it into here, okay? And what you get is an object as bulk, which is a function of phi naught. In fact, it's a quadratic function of phi naught of these sources, right? Because this thing is quadratic in phi. For that matter, you could have higher interactions, but to compute the 2-point function, it will not be relevant. So all I have to do is to plug in this field configuration here, and then differentiate twice with respect to phi naught. And that will give me the 2-point function. And if you do that, which is completely, at this point, is straightforward to do, given that I wrote for you explicitly the solution, so if I take the derivative of the bulk, this is called on shell, okay? So you have the action, and you evaluate it on the classical solution of the equations of motion. So you have, that's called on shell. You have a solution, you plug it back. This is supposed to be OX1. And this is already the first very nice test of the correspondence. Because yesterday we saw how the behavior of any 2-point function of a dimension D operator should scale like. And what you find by plugging in explicitly what this K is, I didn't really tell you what K is, but K is a simple, a fairly simple object. It's something like Z square, delta X square to the delta. Where delta is related to the mass in the formula I wrote earlier today, like this. So that's one way of understanding why I was making up this formula. You get precisely what the symmetries of the conformal field theory tell you that the 2-point function of a scalar field has to satisfy, where this delta is the operator dimension, is the scaling dimension of this operator. And it's related to the mass of the bulk field that we use here by precisely this formula. Okay? Is this kind of idea clear? Because all the other higher point functions is just a glorification of this. It's technically more challenging, but conceptually it's exactly the same. So maybe, I mean, let's stop here and see if this is clear. Okay, so maybe I'll start asking, so since it's clear, maybe I'll start asking you how you would do the following.
You said you do the same thing, you can do the same thing in a natural
analysis? Yes, usually we don't plug things back into the action, but But this is what the prescription tells you to do. I mean, you can always try to solve the equations of motion and plug it back into the action, and then you can get a function of the boundary condition, which is exactly what ATS likes to do. You have to tell me what the boundary conditions you're imposing is. Maybe I will not be mean. I'm not going to ask you to do that. Maybe I'll ask you in the exercise how to, at least conceptually, extend the computation of the two-point function of local operators to the three-point function. Okay. And if you do this exercise, what you'll find is that just like the two-point function in a conformal theory has a special dependence which is uniquely fixed, here there could be a constant. For three-point functions, also the dependence of three-point functions on coordinates is also completely fixed by conformal invariance. And by applying these rules, you exactly get that. So in any conformal field theory, if you compute this, you get some interesting quantity that you have to compute. But the special dependence is completely fixed. So you get x1 minus x2 times 1 half of delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3. I'm running out of blackboard. Is it OK if I erase this? No, sorry. It can be. Plus delta 3. Then x2 minus x3. Remember that I said in conformal field theory is that all correlation functions are power-like. So they fall off with the distance always with a some power of the distance between the various points. These are kind of the characteristic features, the main characteristic feature of conformal field theories. And this is exactly what appears when you study second order phase transitions. And the final distance that you can have, given 3 points, you only have three relative positions. You have x1 minus x3. You have 1 half of delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2. So by applying this prescription for the three-point function, where now we're differentiating, we're solving the equations of motion with this boundary condition, but differentiating the action with respect to the source. Okay, that means that in order to get a non-trivial answer, to get a non-trivial correlator, the bulk action should have interactions. Okay, because if you only had a quadratic part of the action, when you evaluate the action on shell, phi squared would be proportional to phi naught squared. So if I differentiate twice, I get zero. So that means that this will be related to studying in the bulk our scalar field. But of course, scalar fields in ADS or in any space typically have interactions, right? So this would be the typical part. But now you can have things like phi cubed. So now when you solve the equations of motion, this guy, at the very least, will be proportional to the value of the source cubed. So when I differentiate, you'll get something non-trivial. Is this kind of general picture clear? If so, I'll move to, I don't even know, when did I start? OK, so I'll try to give you the other kind of very vivid example that really gives you a geometrical picture of how this correspondence actually works, how the boundary and the bulk theories are related, which is the study of Wilson loops in gauge theory, how they're represented in the bulk. It also will make manifest or explicit the appearance of strings in the bulk. Do people know what a Wilson loop operator in a gauge theory is? What is it?
So you have your gauge field.
Okay.
The loop.
Mm-hmm.
Schedule that.
Mm-hmm.
If you
Yes. With some caveats. It's not just exponential. You have to path order. But this is the basic idea, yeah? So you can define it in any gauge theory that has a gauge field, a mu. You can consider observables. So far, we were considering observables that were local, which means that they sit at a space-time point. But now you can consider observables. And remember, observables are things that are gauge invariant, that lives on some curve C. And that if you wish, you can parameterize with some parameter x mu tau. So a very simple example of a parameterized curve would be, to make it very symmetric, would be a circle. And you could parameterize the circle by saying that x mu of tau, imagine this circle has radius A. That would correspond to A cosine tau sine tau 0, 0. And now you can construct an operator that is supported on this curve and is gauge invariant. And one nice way to think about it is that you first construct an object which is covariantly constant with respect to the covariant derivative. So that's something that you would use to transport fields from one point to the other, which is, so you want things, an object which is covariantly constant. More explicitly, what this is okay, A is a one form, but U, okay? By the way, does this equation remind you of any other equation you've seen in your childhood? You're young, so. Sorry? Schrodinger, it's close to Schrodinger equation, but not quite. Well, it's the equation for the evolution operator in quantum mechanics. So you would say that ddt of u equals, I guess you have a minus I. So what's the solution to this? Sorry? What is that? In formulas? The time order exponential. Okay, so the time order exponential. So in a way, this, the Wilson loop we're going to construct by an analog of that, where the Hamiltonian is replaced by the Gauge field. Okay? And the reason you have to do time ordering in general is that the Hamiltonians, in a general theory, Hamiltonians in different times do not commute with each other. So you cannot just exponentiate madly. Just like matrices. Matrices generically don't commute, so you have to specify some ordering. So let me tell you what the solution is. It's, as you said, it's a path-ordered exponential. It's path ordering here because this is a curve in general, it can be in Euclidean space, so there is no time. While here, you really order it in time. You have evolution in time of the integral. Okay. So far, this can be an open path. So right now, I'm considering an open path. I'm propagating from a point X to a point Y along a parameterized curve that has parameter tau. Okay. And now more explicitly what this thing is you do a power series expansion as this was a standard exponential, but keeping track of the order of the matrices. So the first term is just one. The second term is also simple with the integral. So let's call this thing, not to keep writing the same thing by definition, I call this A, okay? A mu dx mu d tau is just A. Notice, by the way, that if this was in electromagnetism, this is exactly how a particle couples to a gauge field, okay? That's why the interpretation of this Wilson loop is an operator that transports a charged particle around spacetime. Plus I squared 0 tau d tau 1. So far, I haven't done anything. But now I demand that this second matrix always precedes the first one. So I integrate only from here to here, OK? And so on. So let me write one more so that it's obvious what the generalization is. So I keep an ordering. Sorry. Tau. OK, one second. So e tau 1, e tau 2, e tau 3, and so on. And it's obvious how you would continue now. The way you can see that this is a solution immediately is that if I differentiate with respect to tau, you can show that the nth term in the series, the derivative of the nth term, precisely gives you the previous term times a. So let's see that. Let's take the derivative with respect to tau of this beast. So the first term is 0. The second term, what is the derivative of this object with respect to tau? A tau. So you get that ddu is A tau, I guess with an I. Now let's differentiate this guy. If I differentiate this with respect to tau, I eliminate this integral. Tau 1 takes values in tau 1 equals tau tau. So that you get, so the first term is a 1, right? 1 A tau. And the second term is going to be the integral from 0 to tau d tau 2 e tau 2. Is the second computation clear? So then this is exactly the solution to our problem. But in general, if now you make a Gates transformation, so this is called the holonomy, OK? If I make a Gates transformation where u is an operator that transports you from two points in space-time, x and y, under a Gates transformation, it's not invariant. You get that if I make a Gates transformation that a mu or A goes into G, I, D, this is the derivative, plus A, G inverse, where G is the Gates function of the Gates transformation, you find that U, X of Y transforms into G, X, U, X, Y, G, Y inverse. And it's a simple exercise to show this. So in order to make it Gates invariant, what we have to do is choose closed paths and take the trace. Okay? And the rest. So in order to define a loop, then you get the Wilson loop. C is now a closed curve, just like that one. And it's going to be the trace of this path order exponential. But now it's a closed curve. And now it gets invariant because when I take the trace of this beast and x equals y, they just cancel by the cyclicity of the trace. OK, so this was maybe. OK, and what's the physical meaning of this object? This, as I said, the physical intuition you should have about this, that this is an operator that inserts a charged particle, because remember that charged particles couple to the Gates field exactly like this. Inserts a particle that has a word line. When a particle propagates in space-time, it generates a word line, which is exactly the curve supported by the operator. Okay? And this guy is absolutely a fundamental object in Gates theory. You can try to write down Gates theories directly in terms of this operator and in terms of this variable because they're Gates invariant. They are also very important as ordered parameters of phases of Gates theory. They can distinguish, like in a statistical mechanics, ordered parameters do. They can distinguish various phases, like the confinement phase, the fixed phase, and so on. So that they're really important objects. And one would want to know what are those things in n equals 4, because the duality, in AVS, because the duality tells you that anything that you can write down in the Gates theory should have a counterpart in the bulk. So right now we're talking about n equals 4 super Young-Mills. Any quasi-regular Fisher-Perel Mills, apart from having a gauge field, it also has a scalar field. So you can concoct a more general Wilson loop operator that couples to the loop not only the gauge field, write it like that, but also the scalar field. Where ni is a unit vector in R6. So ni, sum from 1 to 6 is 1. OK? So now, in principle, that I give you the explicit definition, you can go ahead and compute what the expectation value or correlation function of this operator would be in this theory. So how would you do it? I mean, how would you compute the expectation value of this operator?
Sometimes in the exponential of the action of the field.
Okay.
And then you integrate over all the fields.
Yes, okay. No, so that, yes, that's good. In a couple of more steps, I mean. So, I mean, the thing that you have to do is take this object and, if you wish, use the path ordered expansion that I had. So then you would have a sum of terms inside the path integral. And now you have to start doing weak contractions among the various terms in the expansion. So if we do it very quickly for n equals 4, the leading term, OK, if you really want to normalize it, you can get a 1 over n here. The leading term was a 1, right? Of the path order exponential, you get 1. So the tracer is 1 is n, so you could just get 1. The first term in the exponential, the first term in the expansion is something that's linear in the field, right? You get 1a and 1phi. The expectation value of that is 0. So the leading non-trivial contribution would come from something like this, where you would, let me erase that, where you would essentially, okay. So what's the propagator of a scalar field or of a gauge field in the Feynman gauge between two space-time points, x and y? So if I give, what is this? I'm sure you've seen this. So if this was in momentum space, it would be? OK, so in position space. And what is that? One very simple way of knowing is that what is the, again, our favorite question, what is the dimension of phi? Yes?
2, no, 1.
1, right? So it means that it has to go like that. Of course, there's some phi, but we don't care about now. So that means that when I expand this to second order, I will get two terms. One that comes from the contraction between two A's, A and A. Because for leading order in perturbation theory, two phis do not contract. Sorry, an A and a phi do not contract. So what you would get is the sum of the propagator of two gauge fields and the sum of the propagators of two scalar fields. So that would give you, given that this is the object that we're talking about, first, you would get the propagator, right? So x of tau 1 minus x of tau 2 squared. That's the propagator. And what you get here is x dot mu, x dot the derivative with respect to tau, like this, dotted into the derivative of tau 2. This comes from essentially take this guy, duplicate it here, and we contract A to A, it gives you this object, and then this guy is multiplied. And this is exactly this combination. And the scalars, and there is a knife here, so there's going to be a relative minus sign between the gauges and the scalar. And here I have the same idea. I have two files that you get from expanding this to second order. I will contract them, that gives you the propagator, but now I have to glue the this factor, right? So I'm going to get. OK, and since I did it to one loop, this is proportional to g squared, in fact, g squared. And now you could, for any choice of parameterized loop, you can compute this integral. In fact, if you do it for the circle, you will find that this propagator, is, this object is miraculously a constant. It's independent of tau 1 and tau 2. Okay? So these are Wilson loops. And the reason I'm going through this is because these are really fundamental objects in gauge theory, and you should know about them. So now the question is, what are those things, what are these guys in ABS? And now, OK, I'm going to do, hopefully that's not going to be too much of a confusion, but I can parameterize ABS in many coordinates. Okay. In this morning, I was using what's called global coordinates, these cylinder coordinates. I can use another set of coordinates that is very useful when I'm trying to study gauge theory in R4. Most of us have intuition about field theory in R4, not in R times S3. At least I don't have that much intuition. I mean, the reason we like it is that in R4, you have translational invariants, and we know how to use that very effectively. You can do Fourier transforms. You can do all kinds of neat things. So if you want to study the duality between n equals 4 super young Mills on R4. This is also, of course, the same as type 2B string theory. Forget about type 2B, string theory. In ABS5 and S5. But now the metric on the on ABS5 is a different one. It's called the Poincaré metric. So the metric on ABS5 is gonna look very similar to the metric of flat space. You're going to have the metric of flat space. This is the coordinates along which the boundary field theory lives. And then, of course, you have to add a radial coordinate because ABS5 has an extra dimension. Let's call it Z. And this is another way of writing the metric of ABS5 that makes manifest the following symmetries. In the global coordinates, some symmetries are made manifest, like rotational symmetry on the three sphere. Here, the symmetries that are made manifest are the Poincaré symmetries of this metric, because now I can make a coordinate transformation to this metric. And obviously, if I make a Poincaré transformation, the metric has that isometry. Okay? And in order to convince yourself that this has something to do with gauge theory in R4, let's look at the metric near the boundary. Again, the boundary is the location where the metric blows up. Where does the metric blow up? It's at z equals 0. And at z equals 0, you precisely get the metric of flat space, okay? Which is just the flat Euclidean metric. So the picture you should have about this, so the boundary where the field theory lives, is at z equals 0. So one way you can picture this is that this is our R4, where our n equals 4 young Mill theory is living. You have a transverse z coordinate, which is the kind of the radial coordinate of ABS. And the boundary you hit at z equals 0. Okay? And when you take the metric of ABS near the boundary, you precisely get the flat space metric. So now, let's ask. Let's think a little bit, how would we construct, what are we doing now when we're talking about Wilson loops? Now that I wrote it, let me raise it. A Wilson loop is, as I said, is a curve that lives here on R4, that is at the boundary. You can think of it as that blackboard. And we have a curve C, and we have an operator that's supported on that curve. And we want to understand, what do I have to do to this bulk geometry? So you have a bulk geometry here that would have the effect of exciting an operator at the boundary that's supported on this loop. And there's a very beautiful answer to this. So remember that this is ADS5. This is the boundary of ADS5. Again, this is kind of a Dirichlet problem. You fix a curve in the boundary, and you ask, what does string theory have? It has strings. So what you ask is, what is the minimal surface in the geometry of ADS5 times S5, which at the boundary is bounded by this curve? Okay. So you've mapped the problem of computing Wilson loops in gauge theory to the computation of minimal surfaces in the ADS geometry with fixed shape at the boundary. This is like a soap bubble problem. You fix some geometry, and then you let the soap bubble fall. We already had some intuition of what is the kind of things that objects that carry a mass or tension like to do in ADS. They like to fall inside, right? Because there is a huge gravitational potential at the center of ADS. So if I stick a string and ends on a loop here near the boundary, it likes to really fall inside, because that's how it minimizes its energy. So then, using the obvious generalization of the rule that we did for local operators, we're going to say that the expectation value of the Wilson loop in the conformal field theory in the semi-classical approximation is given by the semi-classical contribution to the string, to the bulk theory with these boundary conditions. This object, by the way, is a string, right? The two-dimensional surface with the boundary. So you have a string here. So that's how you see that this ADS-60 correspondence knows about the fact that there are strings in the bulk. And the leading classical action associated to this configuration is the exponential of the action of the string with this boundary condition. Okay? And as you know, the action of the string is just the tension of the string, 1 over 2 pi alpha prime. Remember, this is the tension of a string, times d psi 1, d psi 2. These are the embedding coordinates of the string, times the square root of the determinant of the induced metric. You've seen this formula before, right? Okay. Where H alpha beta is the induced metric. So if XM are coordinates in space-time, and GMN is the metric on space-time, this is just the induced metric. Have you seen this formula? Yes. 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 Because you have one dimension here, plus one dimension, 1 plus 1 is 2. Yeah, it's the string. And actually, you can show, in fact, that by thinking in terms of brain, which we haven't developed that much, that you can actually prove this, that if you insert a Wilson loop in the boundary, it's created by attaching to the boundary a string. Okay, so let's do that for the, can I take 5 or 10 more minutes and then I'll stop? That's not possible. Okay, so let's do a couple of examples so that you feel we're gonna go out on a high note. So let's consider what is the simplest curve we can consider on the boundary. We can consider a straight line. This is kind of boring, but we'll see that this is generalized. So this is just a straight line in the boundary in R4 that goes from minus infinity to plus infinity in some, say, in the x1 direction. Now, see, given that you already have, we have developed this intuition about ADS liking to pull things to the center, the minimal surface that would correspond to that would just be a surface that spans z, okay? So in formulas, what this means is that the solution to this Dirichlet problem where you fix the boundary condition of the string to end on a straight line is just this solution. So I have to solve these equations of motion. And what you find is that Now, these are the coordinates. So I'm going to say that x1 equals zeta1. x1 is the coordinate that parametrizes the straight line. And z, which is the radial coordinate of ADS, is parametrized with that. And this is the parametrization of this, the most trivial surface that you can think of, just a straight line here, and then just pull it back inside, which is what ADS wants you to do. It wants to pull the string inside, OK? Now let's do something a bit more interesting that you already seen, actually, in one of the tutorials. Remember that in one of the tutorials, I asked you whether or what is the conformal transformation on the boundary theory that maps a line to a circle. Did anyone answer that question? What is it? OK, very good. If it was along the line, we'd leave it invariant. So now we're going to use this trick to construct the minimal surface that ends on a circle. So this is now a circle in R4. Remember that this is ADS5, and this is the boundary. We want to solve for the minimal surface that ends on a circle. And the way we're going to do it is that since we know the solution for the line, and we know how to map a line to a circle, we can automatically get the solution by acting with this, with the transformation. Okay. So remember that I can go from the line x1 to the circle, as was already said, by doing, if I make a conformal transformation along k2, where k2 is the conformal special conformal transform generator associated to the x2 coordinate, you get a circle. So you go from x m to y m. So these are the coordinates here. These are the coordinates after the special conformal transformation. And as you hopefully did in the exercise, what you find is that you get a circle in the y1, y2 plane that's centered at y2 equals a and has radius a. OK? Very good. But this is, right now, I'm just doing manipulations in the boundary. This has to do with conformal transformation on the boundary. So you might ask, what is the corresponding transformation that I have to do in the bulk geometry to generate the corresponding minimal surface that ends on that circle? And this goes at the heart of another important property of, which I already mentioned earlier today, of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is the statement that any conformal symmetry in the boundary theory has a counterpart in the bulk, which is realized as an isometry. Remember that this morning I said that the conformal group is SO2,4 in Lorentzian signature, and this was exactly the manifest symmetries of the hyperboloid. So all that we have to do is ask what is the bulk diffeomorphism associated to this special conformal transformation. And it turns out that it's incredibly simple. So if you remember from your lectures, I mean from the tutorials, the transformation, how special conformal transformations act. So we have this k, this km. This acted in some way on the four-dimensional coordinates, right? Xm. Now you can ask what is the corresponding Killing vector in ADS5 and S5. So which coordinate transformation corresponds to that? And if you remember the formula, it's going to be almost identical to the action of the special conformal transformations on the boundary coordinates. It's going to look like xi, I guess I'm using m, xm plus vm x squared. OK, let me write it like this, and then So if this was like that, this would be exactly the special conformal transformation that you've seen many times by now in the tutorials. Now we are in ADS, okay? And in particular, we have an extra coordinate. And actually, the thing that's nice is that in order to understand what the associated isometry does in the bulk, all I have to do is replace x squared. This x is the four vector, right? Hope that's clear. All I have to do is add to these four vectors z squared, which is the radial coordinate kind of transverse to the boundary. And z, so ADS, I have coordinates. I told you how this acts. I have to tell you how z acts. So z goes into w, which is going to be just z divided by 1 plus du v dot x, b squared, x squared, plus z squared. Another reason I wanted to do this exercise is that now you can also see a very nice important feature of the correspondence, which is the statement that this as I said, this is an isometry, right, of the bulk metric. But notice that if I go to the boundary, which is at z equals 0, it acts on the boundary precisely as a conformal transformation. And this is true for all transformations. So for any isometry in the bulk, if I look at the action of that transformation on the coordinates on the boundary, you will get a conformal transformation. Okay. So let me just finish. I'll skip a few steps. They're completely trivial, given these transformations to complete. But essentially, all that I'm going to do is take this solution that we had corresponding to the straight line and act with this conformal transformation and with this isometry. That's going to generate another surface in the bulk that will end by construction at the boundary on the circle. Is that clear? And what you're going to get if you do it, so it's completely elementary, so let me just write it down. Y2 minus A squared plus omega squared equals A squared. So you get essentially like a kind of a, what do I want to use? A hemisphere. If you want, I can do another transformation here to simplify things. Where this guy is kind of misaligned with respect to the origin by a factor of A, so I can just do translation, right? To turn this into, I can do a translation along Y2, to just get this equation. And this can be now, this is the surface, okay? This is the surface. And in order to write it as a solution, and as a parameterized solution, I can write it like this. I can say W here. So W equals zeta 1, Y1 equals Y squared minus zeta 1 squared cosine of zeta 2, Y2 equals A squared minus zeta 1 squared sine zeta 1. Notice that this parameterization of the surface in terms of the two embedding coordinates of the string precisely span the surface, okay? So now to finish the prescription, all I have to do is plug in this solution. This is a solution of the equations of motion by construction, because I started with the solution for the line and I just did I acted with the symmetry. So now what you can do is go ahead and compute the induced metric on the surface. So this is the surface sigma. This is the circle. And now you can compute the induced metric. This is completely straightforward also, so let me just write it down. By using the formula I wrote before, where you have the space-time metric and you differentiate with respect to the embedding coordinates. So what you're going to get is L squared over omega squared. Remember that L squared is the ADS radius, or the sphere radius, times A squared Oh, this is zeta 2, sorry. Right? This is zeta 2 plus a square over a square minus z square d. Sorry, it's not z. It should be zeta 1 square. Sorry. This is zeta 1 square. This is zeta 1 square. And this is zeta 1 square. So this is just take the metric and do those derivatives with respect to, these are the space-time coordinates, and you differentiate with respect to the embedding coordinates. So now the expectation value. So now we get to the final answer, essentially. And we have the expectation value of the Wilson loop is the exponential of the string action. I guess I'm doing Euclidean. With precisely this induced metric. And what you find, so I'm not going to do this in front of you, it's completely elementary. You have an L square here. I want to focus you on this factor of L square, because it's going to tell you the dependence of the expectation value of the Tooft, of the Wilson loop as a function of the Tooft coupling. Obviously, these guys are two-dimensional things. When I do the determinant, it will be proportional to, when I do the determinant, it's L square times L square is L to the fourth. But I have to take the square root to get L square. So you get L square over alpha prime times a factor that goes like A over epsilon. And that's what the part that I was avoiding in first pass. I'll tell you what it is in a second. Minus 1, OK? Now, if we want to write this in terms of gauge theory quantities, recall that at lambda, very, very small, we computed this for n equals 4, right? And we got essentially 1 plus a constant, C times lambda times tarara, right? And a strong coupling. This is the answer that you're getting a strong coupling, right? Because this calculation that we're doing here is valid when the geometry of ADS has very small curvature. So classical geometry makes sense. Here we're just doing classical geometry, right? And now using the dictionary I had this morning, that L square, remember that I had that L square, L to the fourth divided, measured in string units, is exactly the Tooft coupling. What you find is that the expectation value, so first, one important technical detail about the ADCT correspondence is that so remember that I said that one has to be very careful about taking the limit when you approach the bulk to the boundary. And the reason you have to be careful is that any observable that you compute in ADS, since ADS has infinite volume, you have to regulate it. So typically what you do is you don't solve the Dirichlet problem at z equals 0. You solve it on a nearby hypersurface at z equals epsilon. Okay, so that things are finite. And it's not unlike in quantum field theory. You put a cutoff, you add counter terms that remove the divergences. And that has to be done for all computations in the bulk of ADS, correlators, Wilson loops, fancier things. And for this case, what it does essentially is the most naive thing, which is exactly to eliminate the divergent piece. So what you get, so we only have left with this finite part. And then what we find is that strong coupling, remember that this was a weak coupling, we find that the expectation value of the Wilson loop is the exponential or minus the action of the string, which gives you precisely exponential of the square root of lambda. So let me just close by saying you should not be alarmed by the fact that the answer evaluated in these two very different limits are completely different. Because if you have a function, and you evaluate that function for a small value of the parameter it should not, in general, agree with the function at the large value of the parameter. Okay, so that's not a contradiction. But I think that's remarkable that I don't have time to, but I would be happy to discuss with you if you guys are interested. It turns out that this particular observable, the Wilson loop in n equals 4, is a very special observable. It's one of the few observables that we have in quantum field theory that we can solve exactly as a function of lambda. Okay? Usually in field theory, we can compute things at weak coupling, and that's it. Because of the special properties of the theory, namely the supersymmetries, in this particular case, you can solve exactly this by reducing the problem from a four-dimensional gauge theory, n equals 4, to something which is much, much simpler and you can solve, which is, again, one of our beloved toy models that we had to learn in the course, which is a matrix model. So you reduce the complication of a four-dimensional, a path integral over a four-dimensional quantum field theory to a path integral over a zero-dimensional matrix model. And lo and behold, if you do this independent computation in field theory, this knows nothing about string theory, and you evaluate the function f of lambda in the limit that lambda goes to infinity, you precisely get, with all the right coefficients and prefactors, the exponential root of lambda. So it gives you a very non-trivial check that the thing is in the right track. By reproducing something, by doing two independent, completely independent calculations in field theory and string theory, and evaluating one of them in the regime in which the other computation is valid. And next week, Pedro will discuss for you not so much correlation functions or expectation values like I was doing here, but attempts at trying to do similar extrapolations from weak coupling through strong coupling for the energy or the anomalous or the dimensions of local operators in Yang-Mills theory and try to compare it with the energies of string excitations in ABS. So if there are there any questions? Should I finish with some moral punchline, or this is enough?
Yeah,
this is great. ABS 50 is really great. that's the punchline. No, I mean, you should not worry about my philosophical thing would be do not worry about whether the duality is true or not. It's definitely true. We don't know how to prove it, but this shouldn't stop you from using it by doing physics. I don't care if you're interested in quantum gravity or gauge theories. It's a technique that people should know. And in fact, now nuclear physicists, condensed matter physicists are walking around with Polchinski's book in their back, precisely because they're giving them tools to at least try to address some questions in their fields. Yes?
This way of looking at the surface, is it the high dimensional analog of the Poincaré metric, you know, the semicircles on the upper half plate? Yes. If you specify two lines on the real axis, you know, we get a semicircle. So this is a high dimensional analog.
Yes. I think what you're saying is that in ABS, you could fix two points on the boundary,
right,
and there is a unique geodesic that connects them.
Right.
This is one dimension higher. But it's the general Sobow problem. You fix the surface, and then you ask what is the minimal action thing that ends on the surface. OK, so I'm available anytime you want in the other building. They don't burn it down. And feel free to come and talk to me.
Which almost 4.6.